Hey, how's it going? Welcome back to the Football Diary Podcast. This is Mike with both Dave and Miles this week, which is a relief for me. I'm sick of hearing my own voice from the last week's pod. Thank you for joining us, though, and good to have you back both. It's International Week, though, so there's not as many topics to talk about, you'd imagine. But actually, we've filled our agenda this week with quite a few talking points, none other than England to start kicking off proceedings, really, and their fairly dismal draw against the Ukraine. But really, the questions that kind of poses about the Southgate approach at the minute and the kind of players he's picking, we'll delve into that. And contrasting that to Scotland's performance so far, 5 wins from 5, and they play England this week again, just to see how the two come up against each other will be fascinating. There's interesting movements with Germany. They are really suffering at the moment. Hansi Flick is no longer their manager. Apparently, that's the first time they've sacked a manager ever, which is mental. We'll be looking at where German football lies at the moment. And also, the issue we haven't talked about yet, which is the Spanish women's national team since the World Cup under the Luis Rubiales situation. He's now resigned in really extreme circumstances and on TV, which was interesting. And also, we've got to unpack Manchester United, really, haven't we? Against Minor Dave's kind of wishes, really. We don't really want to have this discussion. But Miles seems to think that it would be beneficial to try and figure out what is going on at Old Trafford, because it is a bit of a nightmare at the moment. Things just keep coming out left, right and centre. But we'll leave that until closer to the end, I think. We'll start off with England, I reckon, because that's still quite fresh and England's still in the middle of international weekend. So, Dave, you're newly married now. Welcome back, mate. Good to see you. Talking about England, then, first of all, because it was a pretty dismal performance from them against Ukraine, but it was a difficult away fixture because it wasn't in Ukraine, it was in Poland. And it was quite not a hostile environment, but more of a very much a home game for Ukraine with a lot of emotion attached to it. So a point in that situation seems positive. But the way Southgate played the game and also the team that he picked didn't help the cause, really, did it?
No, and I think we anticipated speaking about this. We've looked before the games began, and we looked at the squad that was chosen, and there was a lot of questions about some of the names chosen, and there has been over the last few weeks. But it's frustrating for me because I can understand that it's an away point, but England, if you're going away and you're playing a really good game, but the performance was flat, and the performances from a lot of the players, especially some of the match winners that we've got, were quite flat as well. I think there were probably a couple of players in there that played really well. I thought Kyle Walker had a good performance. I thought Saka had moments as well, and Harry Kane, but it was just a flat performance overall. And considering you had some of these players, like for instance Jordan Henderson, is coming in to prove a point that he's, he belongs in this team, and it just didn't pan out that way. And it's just frustrating because as an England fan, these sort of teams, like, no disrespect to Ukraine, but we should be on a completely another level, really, to them in terms of the personnel that we've got, the way that we play our football. We've got some of the most, exciting attacking players in the world. And the game really was, it's easy to forget, really, because it's just one of those that you don't really want to reflect on and want to forget in a flash. So
yeah, it was uninspiring, wasn't it, in the extreme, Miles? And I think with, like Dave was saying, the talent at England's disposal and even the players that were out on the pitch, the likes of Jude Bellingham and Harry Kane in particular, moved abroad, playing really well for their clubs, having a good season by all accounts. So it has to come down to the coach, really, and Southgate's approach and the way he set them up that has to be questioned, surely. But was it the case of the tactics and the tactical side of it, or are you looking at more the selection? Because the headlines are Jordan Henderson played. That was a big bone of contention. Harry Maguire started when there were plenty of more informed centre-backs. I would even argue Ben Chilwell shouldn't have started, really. He's not played many minutes. He didn't look particularly fit. So how are you judging this game, Miles? What do you think?
It's so difficult to even dissect because, for me personally, I've always been a bit of a Southgate supporter. I've always tried to push and say that I think where he's taken England to has got him a lot of credit in the bank.
Yeah.
This is one of the first times where I've just looked and thought, I don't really understand what he's trying to achieve or what the point in any of this was. Because you're right, it's a really talented England squad and setup that we've got there. Like, we're talking about a team that's got, at the moment, Real Madrid star player, Bayern Munich star player, Man United and Arsenal star player, and then Al Etifak star player, which is just bizarre. Yeah. It feels like Southgate is fallen into the trap of England of old, of kind of having his favourites, sticking with them no matter what. And we've never seen that go well for England before. And I think the performances against Ukraine showcase that. I mean, let's be honest, Ukraine had two attempts on goal, one on target, one was the goal. And for the goal, Maguire is caught all over the place. Him and Gehi end up stood next to each other with Zinchenko in 10 yards of space inside the box. As the shot comes in, that was completely ridiculous. There's no midfielder tracking that run. Really, that should be Henderson's job. So I don't really know what he's in there for. I wondered if Henderson had received the call up to the squad to kind of fill the Connor Cody role this time. Because you remember how people always talked about, yeah, Connor Cody probably isn't going to get many minutes on the pitch, but he's such a leader and such a character in the dressing room, it's worth having him around. Well, Henderson has got a wealth of experience with England. So if you're keeping him around for that, I think I can understand it and it's justifiable. Mm. But if he's starting games in that midfield ahead of players who are in red hot form and can perform far better than he's ever been capable of in that role, it's a joke. Like, there were moments in that game where he barely looked like a footballer. The ball's come to him just outside the box and he's skying it into Rosehead. And that incident where Maguire gets booked, Henderson just air kicks it. And he just looked all over the place to me. Even for the goal, he makes this weird offside run before when Harry Kane's looking for his options. He just looked all over the place. So I don't know. It's disappointing when you've got such a talented setup and Southgate does know them so well to see them kind of flatter to deceive so much, because actually you look at the stats for this game and it looks like England were really in control and it was unlucky that they didn't win, but it was never inspiring, was it? And that squad has the potential to be really inspiring. I just, there's a lot of selection cases that I think need discussing really, don't they? I think it's probably worth us looking at it one by one.
I don't think you can justify that reason, though, of saying, you know, he's got great experience, he's coming in as a leader. Look, they should have leaders all over the pitch. This isn't an inexperienced England team anymore. You know, you've got players in there who've had two or three tournaments and they're still, you know, reasonably young. Like the likes of Harry Kane, Kyle Walker, Harry Maguire even. You know, these are players
who shouldn't be there
when he comes back in. No, he shouldn't be there either.
Well, that begs the question then. Why is he selecting them then? Is it him retreating into pragmatic, conservative, scared of losing Southgate then? Because he's taken chances in the past and we've gone into tournaments and he's actually, you know, made some surprise selections in the past and it's worked out. So we've got reason to trust in Southgate. But did he need to be as pragmatic as he was in this game? And that's the frustrating thing for me.
I don't even know if you can call it pragmatic, because the point of being pragmatic is making decisions that you think are so determined to get you the right result. And I don't think picking Harry Maguire or Jordan Henderson can be considered the logical decision to make. I don't think that tells you that he doesn't want to lose the game, because actually you've got two players of quite poor quality right now in your starting 11. Actually, it'd be far more pragmatic to remove them and go, well, no, of course you don't play. So it's a weird loophole that Southgate's found him in. I feel like he's just kind of clinging on to the success he's had with England and thinking, well, this has come so close to working for me. I'm just going to keep doing it for as long as I'm here. And actually, the strength of a good coach is knowing when to change things up. We've seen that happen at club level on countless occasions. And there are players there that should be knocking on the door now. Like, I don't think it's a stretch to say that two of the centre midfielders that started for England in this game are two of the best centre midfielders in world football right now.
Yeah.
So there is no reason to then feel like you need to put Jordan Henderson in to protect them. Like, Bellingham has the capability of being very box-to-box. He has defensive attributes just as he has offensive attributes. Rice can sit in front of a defence and play incredibly well in a holding midfield role. So why is James Maddison out on the left wing? Why is he not taking that midfield spot? Why are you not giving Eze a go? Really, what is Southgate learning ahead of the Euros next year by picking Jordan Henderson and Harry Maguire at this point for a game like this?
Absolutely.
I understand that Ukraine are probably the third favourites to go through in this group, so you kind of have to get a result with them. But you're not getting a better result with Harry Maguire and Jordan Henderson in your side. If all of a sudden he'd said, this is the game where I'm going to try Levi Colwill and Lewis Dunk together, because they played well at Brighton, they're both informed centre-backs, they've both got a lot of potential and I could use them at the Euros next year. Great, play him in that game. Why is Harry Maguire having to play that game? This idea that because Mings is injured and he's left-footed and because John Stones is out, you have to stick with Maguire, is nonsense. If England had lost this game 3-0, are we realistically in much of a worse position than we are now? Like, just give something a go. Like, let's get something tested.
I think this game would have been a good opportunity to play a third midfielder in there who's a little bit more attacking in nature as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of people mentioned Phil Foden before the game and thought he might get a shout in there as you know, given an opportunity. But yeah, even you mentioned there, Maddison is capable of playing that sort of role. Yeah, he's shifted him out onto the left, and I didn't think he played terrible, James Maddison, but it didn't look functional at all.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I meant by a pragmatic approach from Southgate. Pragmatic in the sense that he's picked players that he's trusted in the past, and it felt like a team that was kind of built from 5 years ago, didn't it? It felt like a 2018 Southgate kind of moment where he still thinks those players are playing at that same level from 5 years ago. So yeah, really odd one. And it kind of begs the question now that is Southgate now been outgrown by his team? Because when he came in, obviously we're in a much worse state. We'd come out of Sam Allardyce's one game, you know, it couldn't have been much lower in the national psyche, could it, the England national team? So the way he's turned it around is the reason why he's got credit in the bank. And when you look back to all the way back then when he took over from Allardyce, you have to feel like we're in a much better position. However, this squad is the most talented pool of players we've had in a generation, isn't it? More than a generation, I think. So do we keep it, the trust in him? Is he the one to kind of get the best out of them? Or is it going to be glorious failure from here on in, do you think, Miles? Because he just can't handle this amount of talent.
It's not going to be a glorious failure. I can't see us dropping off that much. I mean, we drew with Ukraine, but we've won every other game so far. So it's definitely not at a level where I'd be concerned that England are going to really fail in the next tournament, because I don't really know what success is for England. Although this is an excellent squad, it's not the best in world football. It's up there. It's definitely up there. But England have got no right to win the next tournament, for example. Like, they won't be favourites for it. France ultimately will be. So there is still potential in this side. Could someone get more out of it? I don't know who that someone would be, to be totally honest. I don't want someone new. I want Southgate to do something new. And that's quite difficult to get, clearly. But I just feel like the tools are there. And some of the squad selection looked like he was ready to use it. But some of those players must be sat there going, what have I got to do? Like, obviously, there's been a lot of talk about, like, Ben White and his form at Arsenal, and clearly Southgate just doesn't fancy him. And there was that issue where we went home from an England camp previously. So it's a long way back there. But Maddison did it, so maybe Ben White can get his way back in at some point. Someone like Ward-Prowse has started the season incredibly well, isn't getting a look in. Conor Gallagher's been playing games for Chelsea, all right. They've not been amazing, but he's looked quite a bright spark, and he wasn't getting a game in this match. It's just, I don't know. I don't want someone to take over from Southgate. I want the impossible, which is Southgate to just be a bit braver. And actually, you just want him to turn around and go, okay, I can't afford to pick Maguire and Henderson right now in this squad, let alone the starting 11. So who am I going to give the opportunity to fill those boots? Because I'm never going to know who's going to be better than Maguire if I don't try them.
Yeah, I think that's the perspective that we needed, really. Thanks, Miles, for that. Yeah, we're not actually struggling in the group, are we? And that's the thing. We are doing what England always do in qualifying, and that's kind of coasting along. And we never really kind of tear it up in qualifying. We win lots of games, but it's never in massive style. So it's true to form for England. And if we'd have lost it, it would have been a different conversation. So
that being said, if Maguire and Henderson play a minute between them in this friendly against Scotland, you can sack him the next day, as far as I care.
Oh, wow.
Like, there's just no reason point. For it. If I see that, I'm livid, I'll be honest.
There's no point in sticking with that in a friendly like this, although the game against Scotland is never a friendly, let's face it. But
I think it is these days. I don't think anyone cares anymore.
No, I disagree. I think Scotland definitely do.
I don't want to sound like Roy Keane. But when you see Man United and Man City players hugging on the pitch, I feel like England and Scotland might be a bit of that these days. Do you remember when Mason Mount and Ben Chilwell basically caught COVID off Billy Gilmore after an England Scotland game? I think that tells you all you need to know about the rivalry.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, we'll talk about Scotland in a moment, but I wanted to contrast England's fortunes. Although we're saying it's in a weird place at the moment, they are performing okay, on paper at least. Contrast that with Germany. Now, they are hosting the Euros next year. They're in dire form at the moment, and Hansi Flick has been sacked after a defeat to Japan. A very good Japan team, but this Germany squad at the minute can't put a run together. They can't find a system that works for them. You saw the game against Japan, didn't you, Miles? What did you make of Germany, and why have they come to this point now? And why did such a promising coach like Hansi Flick not succeed? This felt like a recipe for success, surely.
It did, particularly when you consider that he was already around the Germany setup for so long. Obviously, he was under Yogi Löw back in the day as well, so he knows what the German national team is all about. He's seen success with them. So, yeah, bizarre. When you consider the record that he held at Bayern and how highly regarded he was, and now he's ended up with 12 wins out of 25 with a Germany team. It just seems mental. And we think back to Germany's World Cup success not that long ago, and you thought that Germany were just on the rise and they were going to be the team to beat for a long time. They're still producing what we would consider excellent players, and they just look so empty. And I wonder if actually a lot of them had given up in this game. Now, granted, it's a friendly 5-6 weeks into the season. So realistically, that fixture is pointless. And if you're playing for an elite European club, are you really going to give maximum effort in a game like this? Let's be honest. I think that's completely encapsulated by, I can't remember which Japan goal it was, where Robin Gosens loses the ball. And you watch Rudiger just watch the Japan players counterattack. He doesn't even try and get back. He just turns around on the halfway line. He's like, well, yeah, we'll see what happens here. Then maybe Ter Stegen will save it. And that either screams of, they don't really want to be there with Hansi Flick, or why are we playing football right now? It could be both. Let's be honest. It just, yeah, defensively, they were so frail. And this is still a team that's got one of Real Madrid's centre-backs, two from Borussia Dortmund. Joshua Kimmich still plays a defensive role with them. They should be far more capable than they let on in this game. And Japan just picked them apart so easily. And it just feels like their confidence is on the floor. It's not a weak squad.
No, it's not. But I see a lot of murmurs, if you like, similar to how it was at Chelsea and how it is at Arsenal at the moment, that Kai Havertz is the problem. Did you see that in evidence here? And have you seen that in evidence that, you know, not having a recognised number nine is probably their issue?
I think they do lack that number nine. And there's a lot of hope that Youssef Moukoko will become that in time. And actually, I will say, I think Havertz's record for Germany is pretty good. I think he's been one of the more consistent players. But it just felt like, I don't know what approach Germany tried to take to this game. It's a friendly, so you give them that. But look at their last three tournaments. Now, I know Hansi Flick only had one of them, but they were eliminated at the group stage in the World Cup, which just seemed shocking. Again, Japan haunting them. The Euros before that, England knocked them out in the round of 16. Russia World Cup, we don't even need to talk about. It was that poor. And this is the side that we remember watching batter Brazil not that long ago. Now, all right, it's a different cycle of players, but it felt like Germany had the project in place to just continue that. And I remember when Southgate first took over at England, all the talk was copy the German model. Get on board with what Germany are doing right now, because they are building for the future. Well, what happened to that future? Because they've fallen apart slowly. And I think there's a lot of players you can place blame on. Maybe Havertz in some areas. But this is a team that's made up of Bayern Munich players who are still considered one of the best teams in Europe. They've got Real Madrid players in their team. Like we said about England, they should be performing far higher than they've managed over recent years. And Hansi Flick, you wonder where he goes from here, because he's had the top job in Germany. He's had the national team job. One was a great success. One was an absolute failure. What's his level now? Where do we see Hansi Flick next? I think is kind of an interesting conversation. And who comes in to save this German squad is the other side I'm interested in.
Absolutely. I think that's the question for you, Dave, because, I mean, the names that have been mentioned, the standout one is Julian Nagelsmann. I've heard Jürgen Klinsmann jokes about as well, which I'm sure is a mick take. But, I mean, Nagelsmann seems like too young to be a national coach, doesn't he? Where does Germany go now, Dave? Because I don't know if a rebuild is the right word I'd use, but they just need a refresh more than anything, don't they? The players seem to be of the right calibre. It's just having a coach that's trusted enough and, I guess, in tune with this team enough to get them moving again.
Yeah, I mean, we spoke about Nagelsmann earlier, didn't we? I think it's probably a little bit early. I can see him going back into club football at some point in the not too distant future. But I think, wasn't Rudi Völler at the game as well? I think he was seen, spotted. So that you'd imagine that there was something going on, ongoing before the game, just to see, you know, who's potentially going to come in. It looks like he'd been earmarked, and it looked like the players had got, you know, had come on to that. He looked like he was going to be on in out of the door. So it's a really difficult question, isn't it? Because we speak so much about Southgate, and if England were to get rid of him, then who would come in? And we struggle for an answer ourselves. And I think I don't think there's a lack of great managers out there, but I think there's a lack of managers who would be willingly, you know, jump into a spot of an international, you know, team. And because I think they still feel that they've got a lot to offer at club level.
That's the thing. I think international football is not the draw that it used to be. It doesn't feel like as a manager, you go to your national team at the peak of your career. It's more like something you do at the end of your career, isn't it?
I saw a rumour the other day about that England are going to try and tempt Guardiola into England when he's done with club football, you know, which is a perfect example. It's
we'll see you in 25 years. The end.
Oh, apparently he wants to go to Spain, doesn't he? He wants to manage Spain, so it's a no-go with that.
To be honest, though, there is one anomaly amongst all of this in terms of getting a major manager to manage at international level at this stage of their career. And Germany, obviously, are hosting the Euros next year. So could the lure of a home tournament, and actually, let's not get it twisted, that squad of players should be in the top four or five favourites for the tournament if they can get their act together. So, like, obviously, the dream candidate for Germany is trying to get Jurgen Klopp there. I don't know how Jurgen Klopp would work at an international side because his methods are so methodical. It would take a really long time to implement that kind of style and the fitness levels required to play Jurgen Klopp's kind of football. But could you see a bigger manager being tempted into it, a German manager being tempted into it, knowing that they're playing a tournament on home soil in 12 months? Because let's be honest, if it wasn't for that, Flick doesn't get sacked when he does. Because
no, true.
Why? I don't really get why they've sacked him now. Did the result to Japan in a friendly really tell Germany that they needed to move him on?
The fact that it was at home as well, and like you say, they are on the verge of becoming, you know, the host of the next tournament, which is the Euros, kind of it paints a really bad picture if this is the kind of form they're in. And it is a run of form that has been horrendous. Yeah, but it is kind of like this is the last opportunity. The last opportunity they had, really. If they'd have let him stay after this performance at home as well, then I'm not sure what comeback there is, really. Like, the fans would booed them to the high heels.
Exactly. So just get rid of him first. Don't even give him this squad. Like, let someone else come in and step in and do that. Because if they'd won 2-0, would he have stayed in the job? Let's be honest, no. Like, Dave's right. Vola was there. The record that he has is appalling. A friendly game against Japan is not one to save your job with. So why sack a manager halfway through an international break? Just, you clearly knew it wasn't working, so get rid of him beforehand. I think it's a bizarre decision.
Well, it's a bit of a rare one where the German FA seem to be getting it wrong, because for so many decades, it seems, we were looking at them as the model, like you say. So it is strange decision-making, isn't it?
I think you're right as well about the planning, Miles. I think it's so short-sighted because we say, it's next summer, but really, that gives very little windows, really, to when, obviously, the next international breaks. There'll probably be another one end of October, one around October time.
You might get
two or three opportunities now
to
kind of piece something together and get those players together, drill whatever you want to drill into them. And it's not as easy as that either. So whoever's going to come in, or if it is Rudy Vola who's, you know, comes in, he is actually in place for next year, then it's going to be difficult who has the job. Anyway,
we've got the issue of the Women's World Cup, which Spain won. Great victory for them, a historic moment for their team, and the headlines have all been taken since then by Luis Rubiales, who celebrated by kissing Jenny Hermoso and, you know, manhandling a number of the players, didn't he, in celebration in the heat of the moment. It looked a bit gross, didn't it, to say the least. He's been on the defensive about his position ever since then, to the point where his mum's gone on hunger strike to defend her son. It's been a real bizarre response from the Spanish FA, who haven't sacked him. I think it's a lot more complicated to sack the head of the FA, to be fair. But they've almost kind of doubled down on his take and sort of said they're going to sue Hermoso as well, which is absolutely bizarre. Well, he's finally resigned on Piers Morgan's show. which, again, to continue this really bizarre feel this whole situation's had to it. And, you know, it should be absolute celebration right now for Spain, surely. What is going on, Miles? I mean, we haven't even discussed the grossness of the topic, but it's very unsavoury to see a man of power, a man especially, in a World Cup moment like this for the women to absolutely, you know, stake their claim to be equals. Manhandled in that way is so odd, isn't it? And it doesn't cover the Spanish FA with glory at all.
Yeah, I think you said that watching it live, it looked gross. And then when you heard how it made Jenni Hermoso feel afterwards, it felt grotesque. It was ridiculous. The fact that it's dragged on this long before any action has really been taken, I think it's ridiculous. It shows the problems with institutions like this and the fact that it's really hard to replace the man in charge, essentially. And it's not a democracy. It's not something that anyone has any say in other than himself. It was only ever going to end with him resigning. And he's finally done that rather than doing it at the right time. And even then he's managed to balls that up, if we're totally honest. He's not done it in the right manner at all in his resignation. He does it on a TV interview with Piers Morgan, which in itself is bizarre. Yeah. And the comments he makes, they're no sign of remorse. There's no mention of Jenni Hermoso or any of the Spanish national team and what he's taken away from them with this headline. All it was about was me, me, me. And my job is untenable because of the attention I'm getting. Well, what you've actually done is disgrace yourself, disgrace the Spanish FA, disgrace the entire concept of that World Cup, it felt like, with mm-hmm. your actions, and then showed no remorse for it afterwards at all. And this comes after Jorge Vilda was sacked for basically just backing him, yeah. which is just mental. And I think it was said that originally Vilda was due a contract extension and $500,000 a year deal as a reward for his loyalty, basically. That whole thing's been an issue for a really long time. The culture around that team's disgusting. Let's not forget that I think 15 players refused to play for the Spanish national team because of the issues they had with Vildas himself mm-hmm. and the way that he was treating the women of that team and the unfair conditions he was putting them through. Some of them had the courage to speak out and they were just completely ostracized. So we know that this setup is problematic, and seeing how long it's taken to get to the right result, it pains you. And I feel like this is the second time we've had that conversation, because yeah. not long ago we were sat having this exact conversation about Mason Greenwood, and I'm sure we'll come on to that in a minute, about how eventually the right decision was made, but it was after a litany of errors and a really prolonged period of just blunders, basically. And it just feels like we take so many steps forward and we see the absolutely outstanding reception that the Lionesses received, for example, the incredible standard of football that we saw this tournament have, clearly excelling the women's game. The WSL is at a whole new level now. That Spanish team is phenomenal. We see all that progress. And actually then we have these reminders that football is still as toxic and divided as it's ever been. It feels like it's heartbreaking. And I hate that it's gone out on these terms, personally.
And Dave, we always talk on this pod about women's football and the rise of it, especially the WSL in England. The Lionesses have done loads of work to try and, you know, get some kind of share of the limelight and some reward, really, financially as well, for growing the women's game. I think it was 200% growth in attendances for this World Cup, which is insane. And the WSL's seen a similar kind of growth, isn't it, where season on season, fans are coming out to watch in women's teams now. So situations like this, where it's almost like institutionalized sexism within the Spanish FA, it undermines the whole growth of the game so much, doesn't it? But then to see the Spanish players respond, and the men's players, to be fair, to sort of down tools and go, whoa, until this has changed, you know, you're not getting anything from us, is kind of encouraging as well at the same time.
I think it was just such a shame that the whole situation overshadowed the, you know, the achievement that, you know, that Spain managed, and they had an absolute phenomenal competition. And it was really just completely overshadowed by, you know, this hideous situation that kind of obviously the tournament ended with. And it's just not what you want, is it? And that's the real shame for me, is that actually over the last few years, we've seen that the women's team, the Spanish team, you know, doing really well and kind of actually progressing really well and developing, you know, extremely well. A lot of the players that are coming through, some great talent, and they were building towards this, and in the end they've probably not actually managed to sort of get the right sort of attention that they would have liked, and that's a real shame.
This situation, the line being drawn under it, in some ways is a relief to see. But again, the way the line has been drawn under it, it's not really definitive, is it, Miles? And that leaves a sour taste as well. How can the Spanish FA and how can women's football globally kind of put a line under this kind of situation altogether, really, and this kind of treatment of female players?
I'll be interested to see how the Spanish FA elect their new president, essentially, and see they can be a bit wiser in their choice if they're not opening it up and making that a more, I don't know, a bigger conversation rather than just a selection. I think that's a really important thing. I'm really glad that they're going to do so with a new manager as well, because Jorge Vildas, the whole thing around him was just, it was so unsettling. Even the way he was behaving on the touchline was just vile. Like, his conduct throughout the tournament just made you want Spain to lose, which is such a shame, because it takes the limelight away from some of the most fantastic players we've ever seen in the women's game, like Bon Mati, Portelas, Hermoso herself. Like, we've seen some incredible talent from that Spanish team. And actually, regardless of being an England fan, you were rooting against them just because I didn't want to see that slimy weasel get any kind of success. So I'm excited for Spain that they've still got that excellent roster of players, and now they might be able to rebuild something, because they managed success in the face of adversity massively this year.
Yeah.
What could that Spanish side go on to achieve? We're talking about the kind of dominance that the Spanish men's team had for a period of time as well, if they can get things right. So, yeah, it's a messy process, but I think you've seen now there are kind of allies to the game, and there are people that are willing to stand up with it, as well as the kind of game itself being far more united from a player's standpoint. That needs to continue, and it needs to spread to the people who govern it. And actually, that's been the problem for years, whether in the women's game or the men's game. The people that govern football just don't seem fit for purpose most of the time. So, I don't know. I think you came to me then for some optimism of what does Spain do next. And the sad reality is whatever they're told to do, and I hope that changes soon.
Okay, thank you for that glowing extra remark there.
Can we talk about something nice?
The next topic of conversation, unfortunately, is Manchester United, Dave, and the state of the club at the moment. And yeah, you laugh, but I mean, there's so many situations, so many issues coming to United at the moment that just raise so many questions about the way the club's been run over the last 15 years or so. And let's start a few. The way the Jadon Sancho situation is at the moment, the fact that Manchester United have got the highest loss of net spend over the last, decade or so. Mason Greenwood, the handling of that situation, the fact that we signed Antony, even though he's got so much hanging over his head. The list goes on and on and on, doesn't it? But can I start with you, Dave, and say, is there any one of those situations that's made you feel more concerned than any of the others? Or is it literally a culmination of a culture at United that just isn't right at the minute?
Oh, for sure, it's a culmination. It seems to be one thing after another at the minute. That's the thing. We don't seem to go even a matter of days without hearing something else, you know, about the club. And it's just been really ugly. That's the matter of it. Especially, you know, the last few weeks, the whole situation around Mason Greenwood, United not making a decision one way or the other, and it looks like it all came out apparent now that they actually plan to keep him. It was only on the back of, obviously, the social media reaction and the media reaction itself that, obviously, they redrew their plans. And but I've seen ridiculous things as well. Like, I think it was at the Times that apparently United did all the PR for Getafe when they were unveiling him, which is another ridiculous thing. But it just wouldn't surprise you at all. But it is, and the thing is worrying me actually now is it's filtering into the dressing room. We've known this anyway. I mean, I spoke to you before, and I just said, surely it's impossible as a member of staff of that club to not be concerned about what's going on with the ownership, you know, the indecision there, whether you're going to have a job, obviously when it does change hands, if it does. And then obviously it comes to the players, and it almost seems now that, I don't know if there's somebody leaking things, and it definitely seems like that And that was something that actually stopped for a while when Ten Hag first came in. It almost seemed like that stopped. Well, obviously, when he got rid of Ronaldo, I think Dean Henderson was one who was a bit of a bad character as well. But it seems like it's all coming back again now. You're hearing stories, you know, daily, really, from The Athletic about Jadon Sancho, not his mentality, about the players don't want him there, they've had enough of him. And it's just so toxic. The whole atmosphere around the club is toxic.
For a club that seems to be claiming that it cares a lot about public relations and what the public think of their decisions, they're making a lot of wrong decisions that are really damaging the way the club is seen, aren't they, Miles? And I think from a United fans perspective, you'd at least hope they try and say and do the right thing in each of these situations. It feels like they've not done the right thing in any of them, really, have they? It's just an absolute rotten to the core situation for Erik ten Hag to be dealing with. And I do feel for him to an extent, but I feel like he could do more as well. It's like the club needs some direction and it's got nothing, has it?
Yeah, because I think that's the most troubling thing. It doesn't matter what scale we're talking about or what area of the club we look at, there's issues all over. So the treatment of the fans, we've talked openly for a long time about how poor that can be. And there was like, I think a story came out today about how the club shop sold out of the character needed for Hoyland's name. So fans couldn't purchase the shirt for the first 2 months of his signing. Like, little admin things like that are going wrong. Then you look at on the pitch issues, and realistically United's form has been quite poor. They failed to address a lot of the areas that they needed to in the transfer market again. And obviously Dave touched on the Jadon Sancho issue, which seems to bubble on in the background, and that causes unrest. And then you've got much larger financial issues. I think they're talking about a loss of £1 billion, which is astounding when you're in a cost of living crisis, that a club like Man United can throw that money away like that, and they're being put on the market for upwards of, what, £5 billion, was it, Dave? Might even be more than that. Maybe 10?
6, don't they, I think.
10 now? Something ridiculous? I don't know. It's whatever it is, it's ludicrous. And that's just the running of the club. And then you think of the morality issues around them as well. Like, we touched on the issue with Mason Greenwood. We've talked about that a lot. I still find it despicable, the welcome he's getting in Getafe, and the way that that's been handled, I think, is shocking. And now obviously everything's coming out about Antony. And I'm reluctant to say too much on that because we don't know the ins and outs of the case with him in the same way that maybe we did with Greenwood. I think there is some evidence and things that is circulating around. I've not seen much myself. I've seen Antony's comments, and you don't want to jump the gun with that and say, well, he's done exactly the same thing. But you're right, Mike, the decision to bring him in with all of this lingering over them, that seems bizarre. And when you've just had this situation with Mason Greenwood and handled it quite poorly, you'd like to think they'd be proactive in dealing with this one, right? The difference being Mason Greenwood was an academy product and classed as pure profit. Whatever happened with him financially, he wasn't really a big asset to lose. Whereas Antony, they've spent so much money on him, it feels like he will get more protection. And that's a scary thought. Then we have this whole issue with the former women's team coach. I think it's Jeff, is it Konopka, Dave? You'll probably know his name better than I do.
Yeah.
Who, a convicted sex offender and paedophilic crimes against girls under 16, and they're inviting him to the first WSL game at Old Trafford. It's just, they're so short-sighted, Man United. They don't think anything through. They seem to be able to defend anyone they want as long as it seems good for business in some way. And what's ironic is they're harming their own business with these awful PR stunts every 5 seconds. They're clueless. And there's no sign that that improves, because then they get taken over by Qatar. And then who knows? There's a whole new debate around that then. It's, mate, I feel for you too, I'll be honest. Because I don't want to sound overdramatic, but if this was my club, there would come a point where I thought, sack this, I'm going to go and start watching Redditch United. Because I wouldn't want to associate myself with the way they're being run right now. And that's so unfair on United fans. So unfair.
The situations where, like for the Greenwood situation, I was genuinely thinking, if they decide to stick by Greenwood and publicly go, yeah, we've decided what we've seen doesn't give us sufficient evidence to, you know, to say he's guilty or whatever, or, you know, we'll stand by the player, rehabilitate him or whatever. And then he starts running out at Old Trafford. I'm not sure how I'd explain that to my girls. I really don't think that's justifiable at all. We know what he's said and what he's done. It's been recorded. So that would have really tested my loyalty to the club. But my loyalty is not endless. I think there's a lot of fans whose loyalty isn't endless. We just want to see our club back in people, the hands of people that care. What's the ideal situation from here on in?
We get this podcast off the ground and make enough money for you two to take them over?
What, worth £10 million? Yeah, that'd be amazing, mate. But
I'll take £10, let alone £10
billion. The truth is, I think it's become that desperate. I actually think fans will take any owner at the minute who actually wants to care about the club, wants to make, you know, the right decisions for the sporting reasons, but then obviously making the right decisions, you know.
Well, we had this conversation with Newcastle, didn't we, as well, how Newcastle fans were so conflicted about coming away from the Mike Ashley era into the Saudi era as well. And, you know, they will get success, but at what cost? And I don't really know if I still feel comfortable with Qatar taking over. I really don't. But then what's the alternative? There's none. It's stick as we are or you know, sell your soul to the devil. What would you take? Oh, blimey. Anyway, being a United fan at the minute, let's try and concentrate on what we see on the pitch, Dave, because, I mean, the most recent issue really is Jadon Sancho. His omission from the last game against Arsenal. I spoke about it on the podcast. And he's publicly come out and said how, contrary to what Erik ten Hag said in the post-match, his performances in training have been good. First of all, that public response from Sancho surprises me, because that is, you know, a complete contrast to what the manager said, first of all. And also, it's a challenge of his authority. It's only going to go one way. And I said that in my last piece for the pod. What do you make of the Sancho situation, Dave? Is Sancho even in the slightest in the right? And has he got a future at United?
I think he's completely in the wrong. And I feel like Erik ten Hag has been very patient with him. Obviously, he had that little break away from football, didn't he, last year, obviously. And I think there was more to it than football. I think it was probably more to do with the mental side of the game. And, you know, he had a lot of patience with him and he brought him back in his own time. And it feels like it's just been thrown back in his face, to be honest. I mean, the thing is, he's been given a lot of opportunities. He's played a lot of games from the start. He's not like he's not been playing football.
He's
put in the odd performance here and there, but he's not put any consistency together at all. And that's the main thing for me. And I think, especially the murmurs around the training performances, him turning up late, and it's nothing new. This is all things that we've seen in the past with Dortmund. We saw it at Man City when he left there. He left in quite bad taste. I think he pretty much went on strike and just wouldn't train because he wanted to leave. So it's nothing new for me. So it doesn't surprise me if it is true. I mean, you're going to back the manager at the end of the day. That's the thing. As a fan, you're always going to back the manager. And, you know, Ten Hag, since he's come in, has done a great job. And he's had plenty of time to look at Jadon Sancho. Let's not forget, it's not just Sancho. It's not just Ten Hag, sorry. We've seen him under Solskjaer, even Ranić, who I don't think took a great liking to him either.
Guardiola, so this is three different. Well.
Exactly. This is three different managers. So I just don't know whether he's got the mental capacity to be able to push himself that extra level, which I think we knew that he was capable from a young age. He was, you know, earmarked as a potential generational talent. He was an absolute superstar in that under-17s team that went on and won that major tournament.
Yeah.
You know, those years ago. And I just don't know where he goes from here. And I saw something actually quite interesting. Chelsea were potentially looking at making a move, but obviously, they questioned his, you know, his mental
age.
Basically his maturity, I think, and his effort in games. That's something that stood out a lot to me as well, that it's just his work rate isn't enough. His intensity in games, he tends to get substituted around 70 minutes because he's not got the stamina for it.
Yeah.
I just don't know whether he's got it for the English game. I think that's...
Listen, I've got a short take on it. All I'll say is, Jadon, if you want to upgrade from Manchester and move to the second city, there's a world-class manager offering European football, and I think you'll do well in claret and blue. That's all I'm saying. I'd call there up, Jadon.
On all seriousness though, Miles, I mean, you followed his progress in Dortmund with keen interest, really, and that's obviously the best of Jadon Sancho was in Dortmund. Mm-hmm. What's the contrast to his performances and his attitude and his willingness there and what we've seen from it at United now, and where do you stand on his future at the club?
Dave's right. There were issues at Dortmund as well at times, being late to training and things like that, that you'd kind of expect from any teenager moving abroad on his own for the first time. So you'd like to think that he would have matured slightly. And Dave's also right when he mentions that this is a player that I think we have to be a bit more delicate with when we consider his behaviour off the pitch in some ways, because I think it was quite well documented that, yeah, he took that break from football to look after his own mental health. And we've seen the effect that can have on a player and their effort, maybe, let's call it, because how long were people calling someone like Dele Alli lazy? And that's not to say that you get a free pass and that you can talk however you like about your manager. But I also think, given the right condition, circumstances and environment, we can still see a player of his ability absolutely thrive, which is why I kind of jokingly say about him moving to Villa, but a club like that, that would absolutely treasure him and make him their star player, just as Dortmund did, I think that would be the real lift that he needs. Because right now he's struggling to get that at United, and he doesn't deserve that necessarily at United. I'm not saying that it's a given that he should be that sort of position, but this is a player that we know has bundles of talent. He was considered the next big thing for England. And when was the last time he was even in consideration for an England squad? It's difficult, isn't it? But the player is still there somewhere. United's system doesn't necessarily suit him that well these days. And he's going to struggle to get, well, he was going to struggle to get in ahead of Antony, particularly if he wanted to play on that right-hand side for a while. So Ten Hag's looked at playing him. And you're right, he's had some game time, but out of position. And never consistent enough, it feels like. He's had a lot of games, but sporadically, it feels like, too. I'd love to see him get a consistent run in the team on that right-hand side under Ten Hag, because counter-attacking fluid football, yes, he's not the quickest winger in the world, but he's very good at starting those counter-attacks. We saw that at Dortmund. He knew where to look for the opportunities for a break. He knew how to spring that last ball. And we've just not seen him do that at Man United. And it feels like there might be a few too many fish in that pond for Jadon Sancho now, and perhaps a move would be the best thing. But
yeah,
you're going to struggle to recoup that money.
Oh, yeah, I think that's the story of our last 10 years though, isn't it? So,
well, Arsenal just let Pepe go on a free, so anything's possible.
One player that arguably should be featuring more for Manchester United, if only he had maybe John McGinn playing alongside him, is Scott McTominay.
Goal machine
Scott McTominay, the top goals, joint top scorer for the European Championship qualifiers so far. And also Scotland themselves won all five of their games in qualifying. They topped the group. They beat Cyprus 3-0 this week. And it's looking really rosy for Scotland at the moment. Steve Clark's got the team playing in a really effective way, pragmatic at times, but also I think attacking enough to kind of look a threat when they go forward. They've got a really interesting midfield setup, haven't they, as well? As I said, McGinn and McTominay are the driving forces of that. So how impressed have you been with Scotland, Miles? What do you reckon to their performances so far?
I think they've been fantastic. And I think actually we are seeing a new side of the Scotland team, because they're very well managed by Steve Clark, as you mentioned. And the quality within the squad is definitely there. I think if you look back to that kind of semi-successful Wales side, well, it's a bit harsh calling them semi-successful. They did very well for what you'd expect of a Wales team, but you know what I mean. There were like real stars in that squad that really shone through, and then they developed players around them. It feels like Scotland are in a similar sort of stage now, but actually their talent spread across the pitch a bit more, because there's some top quality players in there. We've known for a long time about Kieran Tierney and Andrew Robertson at left back, but you mentioned there, McGinn is a different beast with Scotland. I mean, I think he's phenomenal for Aston Villa, and I think he started the season incredibly well at club level. But to see him in a national team shirt, he's a goal machine, which we don't get to see at Villa very often. And the same for Scott McTominay. Now, he's a really interesting one, because I think we've talked before about how I think he came through as a striker, didn't he, at United at first? I think at youth level, he played up front quite a lot. And then for Scotland,
weirdly,
there was this period of time where they were playing a back three and he was a centre back. So he's clearly a really versatile player and someone that you're going to look to at this sort of level, because he's got that quality. He's played at the top end of English football. So it's amazing seeing him achieve. And the players that they've got around them now, it looks like it's only getting better. There's talk this week that Harvey Barnes might change his allegiance and move over and play for Scotland, which that strengthens them a lot, doesn't it? And it, they've basically qualified for the Euros. So who knows? I think Billy Gilmour, John McGinn, Scott McTominay, are there a lot of teams in the Euros that will have a better midfield three than that? There will be some. I'm not saying it's the best there, but that's a good whack, isn't it?
I think you've admitted McGregor there as well, who I think has provided that balance needed. They've got almost this like compact square in the middle of two pivots, and then McTominay and McGinn are just kind of left to go forward, aren't they? And that's been really effective for Scotland in qualifying, Dave, so far, hasn't it? And something that England have really got to look out for in this so-called friendly, haven't they? Because England's midfield at the minute feels like it's a bit up in the air, with especially if Jordan Henderson starts, right?
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see how they approach this, both teams, actually.
Yeah.
Whether England are adventurous enough and try something different, I think it's the perfect opportunity for them to. I don't think they should fall into the trap of it. It's obviously a massive game, the two teams, but I feel they need to take this opportunity to experiment, because there's not going to be many opportunities between now and obviously next year where they're going to be able to try something different. I think a lot, maybe try and Phil Foden in that number 10 role, where he's looked absolutely awesome for Man City this year in the absence of De Bruyne. But you're right, Mike. I think Scotland, the momentum that they've got at the minute, they really look up to going places. And I think it seems like it's attracting a lot more attention from the younger players. You mentioned Harvey Barnes. We spoke about Elliot Anderson, who's really interesting prospect as well for Newcastle. And that sort of player, and you've got to look at it a bit more cleverly for me. I can go and play for a team who, you know, qualifying for major competitions and you know, develop myself furthermore. If you, for instance, you're going to pick England over, you know, over Scotland, I mean, is he really going to start? Is he going to get enough minutes? Definitely not guaranteed. But if you're a young talent and you're coming into, well, I mean, you look at the likes of Ireland now as well. Obviously, Evan Ferguson. There's a lot of, you know, they've under the ages, they've got some great players, actually, Ireland. And it's going to be a similar situation. I actually think that these nations are going to really kind of rise and actually really improve and probably push England. And that's just an exciting thing, I think, for, you know, as in the UK, to see that happening.
Yeah, it's an interesting matchup, isn't it? England and Scotland at this moment in time, Miles. And I think it's a friendly, isn't it, in name, but probably that's about all, really, because these contests tend to be a little bit spicy. Are you anticipating entertaining game, or is it going to contain a lot of needle and aggression? I mean, the last time the teams played was in a major tournament, and it wasn't exactly pretty, was it? So is this going to be different this time around? It was absolutely horrendous. Yeah, you're right. Are we going to expect anything different this time around, I think, considering how the teams have evolved since then?
Do you know what's difficult? In theory, it could be way more exciting, because Scotland are in really good form. Southgate has the opportunity to try some new and exciting players. But if he does that, because it's Southgate and you're so terrified that if you do something wrong, you'll never get back in, you could see the likes of Emery Chiesa coming in and just passing it backwards all game because he doesn't want to lose the ball. Like, I don't really know what to expect. I don't think it's going to be a barn burner, I'll be honest. It'll be combative at times. There'll be a lot to do in that midfield, because as good as we say Scotland's midfield is, it'd be interesting to see who England line up against them. I feel like they should maybe have a look at some more players. I'd like to see maybe Conor Gallagher, Maddison, Foden, like Dave mentioned. I'd like to see Trent in midfield. I'd be really surprised if we didn't see him play in this game. But if we put Bellingham and Rice in, oh, that'd be a good little lineup, wouldn't it? I'd like to see that too. So who knows?
Yeah.
It's so hard to predict England at the moment and what kind of game they'll play, because you think, oh, they're a bit dull, they'll never be excited, and they'll go and spank someone 7-0, and then you think, right, this could be a good game, and they can barely get a shot on target. So who knows?
Well, thanks for that conclusive answer.
That's the kind of high level analysis that people come to this podcast for, by the way. Me going, to be honest.
Cheers for that really inane answer that didn't answer the question, really. Thanks.
I've exhausted all my brain power thinking about all these horrible situations we've covered earlier in the pod. So now you've asked me, are we going to watch a good game of football? And I'm too deflated to say yes.
Do you know what, though? I've just seen breaking news while we've been recording that Paul Pogba's been provisionally suspended after failing an anti-doping test after the Juventus win against Udinese last month. Yeah, so
did he not get injured in that game as well?
Yeah, so he came off as well, but they've detected something in his body that is cause for concern, apparently. I mean, the guy's 30 years old now. He's struggling to shake off injury. What does this mean for Pogba? Blimey.
I think detecting something in Paul Pogba's body that causes concern would probably be knee ligaments at this stage, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Shocking. Oh, dear. True. That's such a shame.
Well, players, apparently, according to FIFA, players can be banned for 2 to 4 years, subject to appeal. So, you know, it's quite a serious allegation.
Oh, my word.
So at the moment, that's all it is. It's the test that's come back the way it has. We'll wait to see what Pogba's camp say. But
well, it did wonders for Andre Onana's career, didn't it?
Yeah, eventually, yeah. But I mean, it's a long time in the wilderness, isn't it? If you are suspended, that's the thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the age of 30, who knows what the future holds for Paul Pogba, you know? Strange.
Do you want one little bit of Man United positivity before we go?
Is there any?
Well, we talked about McTominay being joint top scorer in the Euros qualification. He's joint with two other players. Do we know who they are?
I know one's Rasmus Højlund. Who's the other?
But there you go. Well, a United legend. Romelu Lukaku is the other one. It's past, present, future, isn't it?
Couldn't care less about Lukaku at the minute. Blimey.
Well, Ronaldo's second, so it really is. It's past, present, future Man United. So making all the headlines at the moment, guys.
We'll take that slither of positivity, won't we, Dave?
After the international break, big man, little man, McTominay, Højlund up front.
Don't know, yeah, do you know what? Is, but... I'm not against playing McTominay in a more advanced role after seeing him for Scotland, to be fair. So we'll see how brave Erik ten Hag is at the minute. But that's it for this week's pod. Guys, we've been speaking for about an hour now. For a week where there was not much going on, that's pretty impressive. So yeah, good to have you back and nice to hear something other than my own bloody voice. So yeah, appreciate that.
Shows we've missed you, innit, if we can talk for an hour.
Yeah, absolutely. Whilst you're listening, guys, hopefully you've not fallen asleep on your audio platforms whilst listening to us. If that's the case and you're still awake, please do hop over to YouTube. We're also on all socials pretty much as at Football Diary UK. Give us a follow, give us a like, give us a sub. Really helps the growth of the channel going forward. Until next time, guys, great to see you. Speak soon.
See you later.